radioalburn.com.
Welcome to Truthful Out Radio. Today's date is Friday the 28th of February 2020 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at radioalbion.com. We are not live today, we are pre-recording this because I'm still having connection problems, but we do have with us the producer of Adolf Hitler, the greatest story never told, Communism by the Back Door, the Freemasonic victory of World War II and the soon-to-be-released Churchill's Body Count, Mr. Dennis Wise. Dennis, good afternoon, sir. How the devil are you?
Well, I'm alive. I'm all right, yeah. I had a long podcast yesterday, so this is a little bit earlier than normal, so I'm hoping to be well awake by the time we actually start. But yeah, interesting this week. In fact, came across several things about Churchill, which My unique way of researching tends to dig up, and then I've suddenly got a load of dirt on him as well, which I weren't expecting to find. So that's maybe for a later one, though.
Well, you're obviously better off than me because you got landline internet. I'm hoping mine will be fixed eventually. I'm having to upload things on wireless internet and actually drive to a wireless hotspot in order to do so. Hopefully,
well, this is Wales for you.
Yeah, well, at least we have got a connection, and we can record the podcast for our listeners today. We're going to take a look at Churchill around the world tonight. But before we do that, I just wanted to talk a little bit about donations. I don't like to waste podcast time talking about them, but we do require donations to keep the website going. It costs $100 a month, like just in server costs. Internet costs are another $50 a month, but that's before you even get to the hardware that we need. Unfortunately, we can only accept donations in Bitcoin, or people can send cash if they want, or postal orders, or a check to Grandpa Lampshade's PO box, which you can find on Grandpa Lampshade's pages at the website. But some people have said they've had some difficulties with Bitcoin, so I just want to explain how people can donate with Bitcoin to us. Download an Electrum wallet, install the Electrum wallet. Once you have that, you can then go to localbitcoins.com. And on there, you can buy Bitcoin. You can buy it with PayPal. You can buy it with a credit card. You can buy it by bank transfer. Now, people have looked at this and they've said, oh, but the exchange rate is a little bit less than the exchange rate that's online for Bitcoin. And yes, you have to look at this as it's a commodity that you're buying. If you buy a ton of something, you're going to get it at a cheaper price than if you buy a few ounces of something. You know, when you buy in bulk, you always get what you're buying cheaper. So you have to look at Bitcoin like that. The cheapest way to buy it is through a bank transfer. The most expensive is through PayPal. I think they take about 10% for a bank transfer and about 25% if you do it through PayPal. But once you have Bitcoin, you also get discounts for paying for things with Bitcoin. So it does work its way out. And if you want to donate to us, that is just the only way to do it. And you do have to pay for the convenience of doing it by PayPal. So you go on Local Bitcoin, you put in the amount that you want to donate, you find somebody that's willing to sell you that amount of Bitcoin, you pay them for it, and then what you do on your Electrum wallet, you just click the button that says receive, and that will give you a string of code. You give that string of code to the person that you've just bought the Bitcoin from, and they will send that to your Electrum wallet. Then on your Electrum wallet, you click send, and then you go to radioalbion.com, and you find our Bitcoin wallet identifier number, and you just paste that in to the field where it says send on your Electrum wallet. And then you just click send and it sends whatever the donation is to us. It's very simple to do. And we do require donations to keep the website going. We've had one since Christmas, which is very disheartening when you think of all the work we put in. I was looking at Dr. Johnson's podcast the other day, 8,500 listeners. So you got 8,500 listeners at least to Radio Albion, and only one of them has thought to send us a donation since Christmas. You know, it makes us think, well, do people not appreciate the hard work that we put in? And I don't want to waste podcast time talking about it, but we do need donations. So please, those of you who can afford it, please send us some donations. All right, Dennis, let's get into this Churchill okay. around the world. Yeah, this comes from a fairly left-wing website, so I've had to alter some of the terminology. But he does go into all these different countries that Churchill has gone into, and it caused problems. And there's even more than the ones that we've got here as well.
You have some America.
Yeah, well, there's some we've covered before, isn't there? You know, we've looked at South Africa. We've looked at
Bengal
in India. And one of the things I've noticed is, you know, we're knocking Churchill, but the left, they knock him as well. And they say, oh, he's a white supremacist. He hated these other races. He wanted to exterminate them. He wanted the empire and all of this. What they miss out is he was exactly the same against the Germans. I mean, he just hated everyone, didn't he?
Well, and his own population.
Yeah. I mean, he hated the British as well. He was quite happy to see millions of British die in pointless wars. He hated the Irish. He hated everyone pretty much apart from his treasured Jews, which we exposed last week.
Well, it's pretty much the thinking of the elite. You know, they've amalgamated with the Jews and the population of Britain never really got any benefit from the empire. It was all funneled to the elite and above. So, yeah, I mean, it just makes perfect sense. Not that he's a white supremacist. He's just, a Zionist.
He's a Jewish supremacist more than anything else. I mean, that was the group that he really cared about. That was the group that he was upset about. I mean, he referred to them as my Jews. Look what Hitler is doing to my Jews. We had that quote from him last week. As you say, he claims to have been loyal to the empire. That's the allegation that the left make, is that he was a big supporter of the British Empire. But he wasn't a supporter of the British people. He was a supporter of the bankers and the capitalists that were running that empire and making the profits from it. I mean, we can't forget, they were shoving little white children up chimneys at the time of the empire.
Yeah. And I think it was in the 1940s, they still had them, I forgot what they call it. You know where they used to send people who couldn't afford to live and they'd actually sleep on the stone steps?
Workhouses. Yeah. Still had these workhouses. He wasn't interested in helping the British. And of course, he's not going to be interested in helping Indians, South Africans, or Afghans is the first people that we're going to look at here in Afghanistan, 1897. Churchill found his love for war during the time he spent in Afghanistan. And in his writings, he told us about how he partook in the burning of villages and people's homes. We proceeded systematically, village by village, and we destroyed the houses, filled up the wells, blew down the towers, cut down the great shady trees, burned the crops, and broke the reservoirs in punitive devastation. And that's Churchill on how the British carried on in Afghanistan, and he was only too happy to be a part of it. Churchill would also write of how every tribesman caught was speared or cut down at once. Proud of the terror he helped inflict on the people of Afghanistan, Churchill was well on the road to becoming a genocidal maniac. I mean, surely that's got to be war crimes, poisoning the wells. I mean, breaking the reservoirs, filling up the wells, and what you're doing, I mean, that's a scorched earth policy, isn't it? That's preventing these people from living.
Exactly, yeah. And it's attacking the civilian population yet again.
And, you know, these were Afghans in Afghanistan that he was attacking. Exactly. And part of it was that they had portioned off Afghanistan because the British were concerned about the Russian Empire and Russian influence in Afghanistan, which, you know, they're still concerned about today. But they should have bore in mind that these Pashtun tribesmen, these Afghans, it was their country that they were in. and to, you know, you can win. You can win a battle. You don't have to destroy their livelihood, cut down the trees, burn the crops, and break all their reservoirs so they're going to starve to death. That's not necessary.
No, it's not, but it is a policy, isn't it? Same in South Africa, if there was some kind of crime, you know, some kind of officers attacked, a British army attacked, and the whole region for about 100 kilometres was wiped out, all the farmhouses. Same thing.
It was just gratuitous. I mean, it was the same thing again in India, wasn't it, with the Bengal famine? I mean, part of the reason for that was this scorched earth policy that he had further up, that further in the country, to prevent China from being able to get anything from them. He was worried that China was going to invade and they would partake of the crops, so he destroyed all the crops, and those crops were needed for the Bengalis
to eat.
To eat, yeah. If there was, you know, if there was problems with the crops that year, it wasn't about making a profit. It was just about living. I mean, these accusations are, oh, well, he looked a bit down on these people and he saw them as savages and, you know, wasn't concerned for their lives. But, you know, they're the people that live there. You know, you can have a battle against them, but you don't have to starve them to death and remove away all their, you know, their means of livelihood. Even if he was just looking at them as animals, I mean, you wouldn't do that to animals, would you?
I personally wouldn't. No, I'm not convinced about Churchill. I just think that his whole philosophy is looking down on any population. You know, he's looking to be superior to everybody.
Yeah, a savage attitude. I mean, the people in Parliament thought he was very brutal as well, you know, in his policies.
Mm-hmm.
And that was at the time, because people will say, well, this was just at the time and everybody was like that. They weren't. There was plenty of criticism of him.
No, there were decent people then.
Yeah, I mean, he was really disliked by most of the people in Britain.
Probably why he lost the election, you know, because, you know, the press will tell us one thing, but the real story, or the underlying story, is that people in Britain must have been sick of him.
Yeah, well, he was, after Gallipoli and the whitewash of his involvement in it, when he wasn't found guilty for it, he was sort of chased out of public life, wasn't he? He was gone for over a decade.
No doubt he planned his return.
Yeah, well, this is before all that happened. As I say, that was at the end of the 19th century. And then we get to 1904 in Ireland. In 1904, Churchill said, "I remain of the opinion that a separate parliament for Ireland would be dangerous and impractical. Churchill's ancestry is linked to loyalism in Britain. He is a direct descendant of the Marquis of Londonderry, who helped put down the 1798 United Irishmen Rising. He would live up to his family's reputation when it came to suppressing the revolutionary forces in Ireland. The Black and Tans were the brainchild of Churchill, and he sent them to Ireland to terrorise at will. Attacking civilians and civilian property, they did Churchill proud, rampaging across the country, carrying out reprisals. He went on to describe them as gallant and honourable officers." Now, we've done a podcast on the Black and Tans before, haven't we, Dennis? Yeah, what can you tell us about them?
Well, I mean, obviously it's not publicly known, but there was a presenter of a programme many, many years ago called All Our Yesterdays, Brian Ingalls, and he was an historian as well as a presenter. And he's researched it and found that what Churchill did, he swept the jails of Britain and offered these criminals freedom for going over to Ireland and doing what criminals do. And consequently, the reason they call them Black and Tans is because they weren't a police force and they weren't an army. It was like a half and half, with nobody really able to control them. I mean, to an extent where at one stage they burnt down the city of York. Cork, was an IRA stronghold. And although there was an investigation, or so-called investigation, nothing was ever done. And these people just had carte blanche with whatever they wanted.
So they were just criminals that were sprung free from the jails and told that they would, you know, they'd have the immunity that police officers have if they went over to Ireland and attacked.
There were some soldiers from World War I coming back as well, mixed in there, but yeah, this is what was discovered.
Well, this is similar to, you know, what Saudi Arabia did, isn't it, really? When we had the Arab Spring, Saudi Arabia were telling the people in the prisons of Saudi that their prison sentence would be removed from them if they went to fight in Syria as jihadis. And they freed the prisoners. Yeah, and Stalin later on. But to do this to Ireland, I mean, you could think of doing it to the people that you're in war against, but these are, you know, our Irish brothers that he did this to.
Mm-hmm.
It was also Churchill who conceived the idea of forming the auxiliaries who carried out the Croke Park massacre, firing into the crowd at a Gaelic football match, killing 14. We covered that as well, didn't we, Dennis?
When the tank pulled up on the football field.
There's a film of that, isn't there? You got some good
I used it in the documentary, Amazing.
Of course, this didn't fulfill Churchill's bloodlust to oppress people who he described as odd for their refusal to be English, and he went on to advocate the use of air power in Ireland against Sinn Féin members in 1920. He suggested to his war advisers that aeroplanes should be dispatched with orders to use machine gun fire or bombs to scatter and stampede them. Now remember, this is Ireland. They don't have an army. They don't have anti-aircraft technology there or anything like that. And he's just saying, well, you know, we can just bomb them. Why aren't we bombing them? It gets worse, doesn't it?
Well, I think he was head of air and water at the time. That was his title, wasn't it?
No, he was. Yeah, he wasn't the head of the Admiralty. I guess this must have just been...
He had a few jobs, didn't he? To see, he messed up in them all.
Yeah, well, this must be a lot later on than 1904 if they've got air power by this time. With this
football match. Yeah, well, we're honest, weren't it, when they managed to get the old twin-winged...
Oh, the biplanes.
Southwest with the coal, yeah.
Churchill was an early advocate for the partitioning of Ireland, but during the treaty negotiations, he insisted on retaining Navy bases there. In 1938, those bases were handed back to Ireland. However, in 1939, Churchill proposed capturing Bearhaven Base by force. In 1941, Churchill supported a plan to introduce conscription in the north of Ireland. Well, conscription isn't a bad idea, but I guess he was thinking of, you know, forcing them to join the English army. And, you know, at the time, Ireland was neutral in the war.
Mm.
So to say that...
Funnily enough, I think Dublin got bombed, you know, and nobody really knows who bombed Dublin. I mean, they blame the Germans, but why would the Germans bomb Dublin, you know?
Yes, strange. Do the Germans not admit to doing that then?
No.
And to say here that he proposed capturing the bases by force when Ireland is a neutral country, I mean, what was his reason for doing that? Hitler went into the countries around him to prevent the Allies getting into them and to ensure that Germany had supplies and wasn't put under siege like it was in the First World War. But there's no reason for Churchill to go into Ireland, which, you know, to get to Ireland, the Germans have to cross over England first.
Mm.
So there was no excuse for that.
It's a strange one. Well, I'm saying it's strange. Maybe, like you said, like he wanted Ireland as more cattle fodder for his war.
Churchill went on to remark, "The bloody Irish, what have they ever done for our wars? Reducing Ireland's merit to what it might provide by way of resources for Churchill's bloodlust." And I mean, why should Ireland be fighting for Britain in its wars?
Yeah.
Or England in its wars?
It's funny. Well, they should, some did, obviously, but to enforce is another thing. You mentioned early on, though, in this little script, about Churchill's ancestors being linked to loyalism in Britain. And if you notice, the Orange Lodges in Ireland are steeped in Freemasonry. And I learned this week that Churchill was a 33 degree Freemason. And he was also a member of the Golden Dawn, a cult society, which is one of Rothschild's. So, it's interesting because this again, Freemasonry crops its head wherever there's this kind of thing going on, it's nothing they were far away.
Yeah, the gold, Golden Dawn is Aleister Crowley. That was his society.
Yeah, he left it. That's right, he left it. But I think the Rothschilds actually use it themselves. But it wasn't occult enough for Crowley.
And there was there's pictures of him in his Masonic regalia. You can find them on Google Images. So he's not very well liked in Ireland.
He wasn't really interested in it, because he was a druid as well. He was a druid and a Freemason. So he has to have some knowledge about all this. I mean, why be a druid otherwise? You know, it ain't just a happening thing.
So he was disliked in Ireland along with Cromwell. I mean, Cromwell was really hated in Ireland, wasn't he?
I suppose he looked up at Cromwell, didn't he?
Yeah, well, really,
think about it.
I think there's a similarity between the two.
Very much so. Yeah,
definitely
right.
A similarity there. Well, let's move on to Iran. I really didn't know he had much to do with Iran, but yes, he did. And it started in 1914. When Britain seized Iran's oil industry, Churchill proclaimed that it was a prize from fairyland beyond our wildest dreams. Churchill meddled in Iranian affairs for decades. He helped exclude Iranians from their natural resources and encouraged the looting when most Persians lived in severe poverty. Because remember, it wasn't actually called Iran at the time, it was still Persia. In June 1914, Churchill proposed a bill in the House of Commons that would see the British government become the major shareholder of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company. The company would go on to refrain from paying Iran its share of the dividends before first paying tax to the British exchequer. Essentially, the British were illegally taxing the Iranian government. And, you know, it's British technology that the Persians were using. So that there is a reason for the British to have shares in this company, because it's their technology, they're the ones that developed it. And that should be shared with the Persians, obviously, because it's their land. But they shouldn't be taking tax out from that, from the Persian share. The tax should come out of the British share. But what they were doing was taking it from the Persians.
Well, if they can, they will. I think that's a policy.
Well, this was it, because the Persians couldn't fight back, because all of these people couldn't fight back, Churchill was just, you know, behaving like a bully, just trampling all over their rights, basically. When the nationalist government of Mohammad Mossadegh threatened British interests, and it's got interests in quote marks there, because obviously really they're just banking interests in Iran.
It's huge, isn't it?
Yeah, Churchill was there, ready to protect them at any cost, even if that meant desecrating democracy. He helped organise a coup against Mossadegh in August 1953. He told the CIA operations officer that helped carry out the plan, "If I had been but a few years younger, I would have loved nothing better than to have served under your command in this great venture." And this, you know, Mohammed Mossadegh, I mean, he was who the Persians wanted. He was the democratic leader, and they subverted it and organized this coup. Churchill even arranged for the BBC to send coded messages to let the Shah of Iran know that they were overthrowing the democratically elected government. Instead of the BBC ending their Persian language news broadcast with "It is now midnight in London," under Churchill's orders, they said, "It is now exactly midnight." Churchill went on to privately describe the coup as the finest operation since the end of the war. And remember, that was a nationalist government that he helped to overthrow. And this is why the Iranians don't trust Britain and America. I mean, this goes way back. It goes all the way back to here. I mean, in 1953, where they toppled the legitimate democratic government. And this shows you that the BBC is not some unbiased organization. They're actually working to subvert the democracy of another country here, sending out coded messages to undercover intelligence operatives that were in Persia.
Well, we saw CIA involvement in the 70s, remember? You know, when Carter came, Carter went out, and Bush was behind it in the CIA, the overthrow of the Shah. if no, Reagan, that's it, Reagan. If you can remember, Reagan threw some hostages, and as soon as the election was won, Reagan said something like, let them hostages go, and then within 10 minutes they're all freed. All staged, of course.
And we know that a lot of the journalists are working for the intelligence agencies. A lot of them are,
in the pay of them. Yeah.
That was all exposed in the 70s as well. It had a name for it. I'm not sure what the operation was. It showed it was something like a third of all the journalists in the mainstream press were working for the intelligence agencies.
Well, it shouldn't surprise people, really, because, like I said, that's been one of the strengths that when the British Empire went around the world and they were imprisoning people in South Africa, doing certain things in Ireland and other places, the real British people who would obviously object themselves to all this never knew about it because the press was controlled.
Well, the same goes on with these reporters that are embedded with the rebels in Syria and things like that. When you hear about these journalists that are embedded, they're usually embedded there because there's something to do with the intelligence agencies. You know, otherwise it would be a very dangerous position that they were in. And this is why they provide this biased reporting. You know, we saw it in Libya, we saw it in Syria, and they have these, and Iraq, yeah, they have these links with the intelligence agencies.
So didn't the Americans bomb the Iraqi TV station? I think Bush said it was an accident or something. But I'm not convinced.
It wouldn't surprise me, but yeah, Iraq is the next country that Churchill was involved in, starting in 1921, where he was appointed Secretary of State for the Colonies, and he formed the Middle East Department, which was responsible for Iraq. And basically what that means is that the lines on a map which demarcated Iraq, which actually had three different groups of people within it, and this is why we still have problems with the Kurds today, and they say, we want Kurdistan, and you've got Kurds in Syria, you've got Kurds in Iraq, you've got Kurds spilling over into Turkey, and that's because the Kurds were deprived of having their own territory by these lines that were put on a map, and you had these so you then had Kurds and Iraqis and Persians all in this one territory, which is why there was problems, why there was, fighting, why Saddam Hussein was having problems with Kurds, why Turkey has problems with Kurds today. It's because, diversity doesn't work. Even when you've got people that are very close ethnically, if they're put into one territory, eventually they're going to start fighting. I mean, we have the same here in Britain. Yeah. I mean, the Irish are pretty much very close ethnicity to the English. And yet we've had, years of fighting between the Irish and the English, and the same in the Middle East with the Kurds and the Iraqis and the Turks. Diversity doesn't work. History shows us that. And this is another reason.
Funny enough, there was something about Turkey last night. I'm not sure if you heard about it. There were some Turkish soldiers were bombed, believed to be the Soviet Union. Well, sorry, not Soviet Union, Russia was involved in it. But they're not blaming Russia. Apparently, they're blaming Syria, and now they're threatening, because they've got a million refugees. Turkey's now threatening to let these refugees into Europe. So the plot thickens.
Yeah, the Turks were embedded with the terrorists, and Russia and Syria bombed the terrorists, and they hit 33 Turks that were there with the terrorists. And Turkey's saying, well, we let Russia know about this, that they were there, and the Russians went in and gave aid to the injured Turks, and Russia was saying, well, we didn't know anything about this. And okay, so we can understand that bit, but I don't understand how that ties in with Erdogan saying, well, in response, we'll let all these refugees into Europe. It was either Russia or Syria that bombed them, not Europe.
He's looking for something from the UN, I think, isn't he? Because Europe actually pays him not to let them in. He doesn't do this from the goodness of his heart. Turkey's well paid to keep these refugees in this one place. So I think he's looking for something from the UN or something like that for backup. Otherwise, he's going to let these flood Europe.
Blackmail once again. Well, all they've got to do is defend the borders of Europe. Treat these people as an invading force, which is what they are. Hungary manages to keep them out. all band managers to keep them out.
They refuse to do it, they refuse to have in their eyes any borders. So, you know, it's going to cause complications.
We'll have to keep an eye on that, see what happens there. But getting back to Iraq, with no thought for honour or fair play, he decided air power, could replace ground troops, and a strategy of bombing any resistance to British rule was now employed. Yeah, you think about that. You know, these people have probably, you know, never seen an airplane before. And suddenly they see a shadow overhead and fire rains down on them, on their heads.
It all gets to me where it says, like, you know, it's the British rule. Well, it is the British rule, but it isn't the British rule. Not the true British. This is the elite and their amalgamation with the Judaics.
The British weren't very pleased about this. The British were the sort of people that put pressure on, you know, on the government to get rid of slavery. They weren't benefiting from the British Empire, not in any way. Several times,
it's not cover up because Muslims, I think, look back in history, look what the British did to us. And yeah, okay, the British population, the men are good soldiers, but they were being told and ordered what to do by the above, who were what I call British.
Lions led by donkeys. That was the phrase. Several times in the 1920s, various groups in the region now known as Iraq rose up against the British. The Air Force was then put into action, indiscriminately bombing civilian areas so as to subdue the population, which is, of course, a war crime. This is where Churchill got the idea from, to do the same to the Germans, bomb their cities. Churchill was also an advocate for the use of mustard and poison gases. While Secretary for War and Air, he advised that the provision of some kind of asphyxiating bombs should be used for use in preliminary operations against turbulent tribes in order to take control of Iraq. And remember, this is after the First World War. This is after the horrors of using poison gas had been seen. He wanted to use it on these tribesmen. Just incredible. I mean,
I'm still trying to get all this film, Young Winston, because I can remember seeing it in what the old picture out is like on one side, but I haven't been able to get hold of it as yet. It's like, you know, where he's glorified again by Hollywood as this charging of kind of a light brigade type of thing in Afghanistan. It's an eye-opener. I think if I can get hold of it, it would be really good.
Well, this is the origins of the, you know, the Muslims' animus against the British, really, is through Churchill. Because, you know, the British were quite, you know, they were quite kind to the Arabs. They didn't see them in a bad way at all. I mean, the British, the House of Lords
fair-minded peoples. They've always had, but this is why I never blame them for the Blueberry. The fair-minded people, same with the American population as well, they're very similar. But it's the leaders who have this kind of ruthless streak, which they don't think much of the populations anyway. At the end of the day, you've got to imagine, you know, there's 20,000 estimated ISIS fighters that has come back to this country. But what government in the right mind would bring these fighters back to a country which has just bombed them?
Incredible. But, you know, the British people, as we said last week, the House of Lords voted to stop supporting Israel, and that was because of the mistreatment of the Arabs. And at the time of the Balfour Declaration and after, they were saying, well, what about these Arabs? We've never had a problem with them. You know, they're nice enough people. They're a little bit behind us as far as civilization is concerned, but they're not a problem. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the reason why they dislike the British is because of this, because of Churchill and what he did over there. Not actually because of the British people. And, of course, now we're stuck supporting Israel, but there was more support for the Arabs than there was for Israel at the time. When Iraqi tribes stood up for themselves against Churchill, the British unleashed fire terror on mud, stone and reed villages. Churchill's bombing of civilians in Mesopotamia, Kurdistan and Iraq was summed up by war criminal Bomber Harris. He said, "The Arab and Kurd now know what real bombing means. Within 45 minutes, a full-sized village can be practically wiped out, and a third of its inhabitants killed or injured by four or five machines which offer them no real target, no opportunity for glory as warriors, and no effective means of escape. Arthur Bomber Harris. This is part of it as well.
That's in Germany, that many years later.
Yeah, well, this is the thing, isn't it? There's no honour in doing that either. You know, they can't fight back. They're just, you know, it's just shooting at ducks in a barrel. Something like that would never have been entertained, you know, 150 years ago, back when we still believed in chivalry and honour.
Nobility, yeah.
You know, something like that would never have gone on for centuries up until the last century, when this sort of thing was started pretty much by Churchill.
Same with the Sea War.
Saudi Arabia, 1922. And here we get a change in the way that Churchill treats people, which I find really, really interesting, because don't forget Israel gets on very well with Saudi Arabia. Prior to 1922, the British were paying Ibn Saud a subsidy of £60,000 a year. Churchill, then colonial secretary, raised it to £100,000 a year. He knew of the dangers of Wahhabism, that's what became the Islamic State, but was content to use the House of Saud's twisted ideology for the benefit of British imperialism, just as the British had done a few years earlier when they teamed up with Al Saud and their Wahhabism to wage an internal war in the Ottoman Empire. He described Ibn Saud's Wahhabis as intolerant, well-armed, and bloodthirsty. Of course, as long as they were on Winston's side, he was happy. Churchill went on to write that his admiration for him, Ibn Saud, was deep because of his unfailing loyalty to us. Churchill met with Ibn Saud, whom he showered with money and gifts. He even gifted Ibn Saud a special Rolls-Royce in the mid-1940s for services rendered in foisting Wahhabism on the region. And that is extremist Islam. That's literalist, extremist, Sharia law Islam, Wahhabism. And it was encouraged by Churchill and by the intelligence agencies.
And, and when he says was loyal to us, I don't think he's talking about Britain. It's like you said earlier on, Israel and Saudi Arabia get on very well.
Well, it was loyal to the bankers. I mean, it's the same thing today, isn't it? Look, you know, where do ISIS go? Well, they're sent into Syria to attack the enemy of the banks, to attack the enemy of the West. They're not going into Israel.
Hospital treatment for wounds from Israel.
And it was the same in this time. There were nationalist writers writing in the 30s that were warning about Wahhabism and the dangers of promoting it, and how the British Empire was using these Wahhabi jihadis and sending them into areas to fight against the enemies of the empire.
And same with Libya.
Yeah, same with Libya, and these Saudis that we're aligned to, that's now their specific form of Islam that they export to all the mosques in Britain. Russia won't have won't have mosques that are paid for by Saudi Arabia. They say, no, we want if we have Islam in our country, it needs to be the Islam that has grown here without outside influence. But in Britain, they say, oh, no, it's quite happy to have Saudi Arabia buy all these mosques and send all these imams over and teach Wahhabism
to the Muslims. I think we should build some Christian churches in Saudi Arabia, is that what you say?
Yeah. Yeah, there's fat chance of that. Fat chance of that. But we can see here that this alliance with the Arabs and with Saudi Arabia, I mean, that goes back a century.
Yeah, it's still going on.
Supporting them.
These things run deep. We're not taught them in history at school. So when suddenly Blair wants to attack Saddam Hussein, it's new. People aren't aware of not the ordinary person in the street that we've ever been in Iraq before or in Afghanistan.
And it used to be part of the British Empire, part of a protectorate, I should imagine. Not actually sort of colonised and occupied, but a protectorate. The British were protecting it, and that's why they divided the map up.
Mm.
Moving into 1944, at the end of the war, we get Churchill in Greece. The British Army, under the guidance of Churchill, perpetrated a massacre on the streets of Athens in the month of December. 1944, 28 protesters were shot dead, a further 128 injured. The British demanded that all guerrilla groups should disarm on the 2nd of December, 1944. The following day, 200,000 people took to the streets. And this is when the British Army, under Churchill's orders, turned their guns on the people. Churchill regarded the ELAS, the Greek People's Liberation Army, and the EAM, the National Liberation Front, as miserable bandits. But these were the very people who had been fighting against Germany on the Allies' side. These were, these were partisans. These were communist partisans. So, you know, he turned on his own people.
This about a week ago, you know.
Tell us some more.
I was speaking to somebody, and they said that the Germans actually got blamed for all this. People in Greece still today think the Germans were to blame.
Well, they think the Germans were to blame for this massacre.
Mm. Yeah, yeah. Not even me, you were spunning.
Because, Churchill was just against them, even though they were, fighting against the Germans. Yeah. I mean, this guy that's writing this, he's a pro-communist, and... he says that this is because Churchill just didn't like the Greeks.
Didn't like communism.
Thought that they weren't white. But, Churchill did like communism. Yeah, and he was saying that, and he didn't like communism, but Churchill had been allied with Stalin throughout the war.
Yeah, plus the swap sides with China at the end of the war.
Do you know much about what happened with Greece during the war? It was occupied by the Germans, wasn't it, near the end?
Well, yeah, I mean, they tried to get some kind of resistance just before he was going to Russia, and he had to go down there. I think Mussolini invaded, I think, but he needed some help, because Hitler actually said that of all the fighters, the Greeks were the one he had most respect for, because they took some putting down. But eventually they did put him down. But it was the British government which was causing all the, uprisings. And obviously they turned on him in 1944 at the end of the war.
So like the other resistance movements, it was Britain and the Allies that were supporting them.
Yeah, and then when they didn't need them, turned.
And also, I mean, Mussolini went into Greece, didn't he? Just as Hitler was preparing for Operation Barbarossa, and that put Operation Barbarossa back by 6 weeks. So he could go in there and rescue Mussolini and his harebrained schemes. And of course, that's why Barbarossa failed, because it was too late.
Winter,
and the winter came in and froze everything up. Have you seen what Michael Hoffman's been saying about that?
Yes, I have, yeah. And the only comment I can give on that is whatever he writes in any book, any words he writes down, as he is doing it presently, does not compare to the fact that the Holocaust cannot be debated. That fact alone, as long as that it cannot be debated, speaks more volumes than anything he can write.
Well, he's trying to say that... that this preemptive strike wasn't a preemptive strike. And he says that the people only ever bring up the book that was written that says that Stalin was preparing to invade Europe. But there's a ton more evidence than that.
Super off. Oh, yeah, a lot more evidence than that. Even, like, as I said, Brezhnev's memoirs mentions the fact that Stalin's going to invade.
All the tanks lined up, all the troops lined up, ready to invade Europe. I mean, that's why. Irish
troops, an attack force, yeah.
Yeah, that's why Hitler was able to get in there. And Hoffman says, it was a harebrained scheme. They never could have taken Russia in that time, and yet they got to 50 miles within Moscow. And it was only because of the freak weather.
Yeah, they were fighting actually on the streets of Moscow almost, yeah. So weather what put them back, obviously, because everything froze up. And then, obviously, Pearl Harbor at the same time, and the Americans, they won't. The war eventually was second front, but that also stopped Japan from coming in from the other side, because if the Germans had come in from the west of Japan and had come in from the east, they'd have been sandwiched.
Well, I've always had a lot of respect for Michael Hoffman. I've always known that he wasn't a supporter of National Socialism, but, I've got his other books, Judaism Discovered. It's a great book. They were white and they were slaves. It's a great book. Occult Renaissance Church of Rome. That's another good one. And, I've had a lot of respect for him, but having a look at what he's saying now, about Hitler. It's making me question the authenticity of these other books. I read the first chapter of it, and he tries to say that the whole of National Socialism was based on the protocols of the learned elders of Zion. And I can't remember reading that much about the protocols in Mein Kampf. I don't think Hitler mentioned it. He may not even mention it. But it wasn't based on that. And what Michael Hoffman says is, oh, it would have been much better if Hitler had based everything on Entdeckte's Judaism, which was this another book that was written about 100 years before the protocols. And I have this book. And basically, it's a Christian refutation of the Talmud. It exposes what it says in the Talmud and then it exposes it as being against what it says in the Bible. And there is no way on earth that would have woken people up to what was going on. If you compare that to the protocols just describes everything that's going on, the subversion of everything, the promotion of Darwinism, sure. The promotion of democracy. None of that is covered in this Entdeckte's Judaism. And, you know, it's such a weak argument. I couldn't believe that he was actually making this. And Hoffman himself sells copies of this Entdeckte's Judaism book. And I really don't want to believe that he just put that in there to try and sell copies. But, you know, his integrity, I am really starting to doubt his integrity because of this. And he's saying, why aren't people debating me over this? And, you know, from what I've spoken to people about this, they said, well, they don't want to, you know, they don't want to draw attention to it. They don't want to give him the, the credit of debating it. Mm-hmm. It's not worth debating. It's just so ludicrous that people don't, you know, they're not going to give him, what's the word? Stature?
Platform, yeah.
Respect, yeah. A platform. Yeah, they just don't want to give him a platform because it's, you know, it's ludicrous, the things that he is saying.
Well, it looks like he's, I don't know if it's true or not, but it looks like they've, like what's happened to many others, you know, is suddenly, you know, have they been offered some kind of sounds money? You know, it seems he's turned.
Well, it's like David Irving, isn't it? I mean, David Irving went back on his views and it seems that, you know, he's... you know, he just doesn't want, they've crushed him basically, sending him to prison, destroyed his reputation, took all his money. And, you know, he wants to be remembered for being a great historian, which he is. And yet it all gets tarnished by this Holocaust denier. So he's come up with flimsy reasons for saying that, it did happen. I mean, I've heard his podcast where he comes out with the evidence and it's really no evidence at all. You know, there was a requisition for diggers. Diggers and digger drivers at some point on the Eastern Front, and he says, and that's proof that the Holocaust happened because they had these diggers. But there's all sorts of reasons they could have needed diggers.
The cost of that court case must have been unreal, and I think he must have just struck a deal.
Well, either struck a deal. I don't know about that because they still attack him in the media.
Yeah, well, they're always going to attack him. But yeah, you're right. But with this, I mean, there used to be a guy on YouTube who did a great documentary about Treblinka and a couple of others, and he just suddenly switched completely. 100% switched.
Eric Hunt, yeah. I think maybe there was threats to his life or something. There had to be, because, I mean, he's never come up with any reasoning for why he changed his views. He just... you know, stopped challenging it. And he was fantastic at challenging it. And he really had, really had balls. I mean, he was, you know, really courageous for the truth. And then, I think they must have terrified him with some kind of threats that he must stop doing what he was doing. Because, that Treblinka documentary did. And Last Days of the Big Lie, where he went through all the witnesses that... or so-called eyewitnesses that Steven Spielberg had recorded and found loads that were saying...
In the documentary,
saying, well, this didn't happen. There weren't any gas chambers.
No, we
were treated very well. Yeah.
Blades, Christmas blades.
Yeah, some amazing work that he did.
Totally different outlook.
I think you can still get those videos at the Holocaust Handbooks website, which has... loads of books and videos, well worth checking out. Anyway, we've got one more country to do here that Churchill visited. Kenya, in 1952. Britain declared a state of emergency in Kenya in 1952 to protect its people from violent black rioters. Churchill's response was to approve the forcible removal of the entire local population. 150,000 men, women and children were forced into concentration camps. Children's schools were shut and branded as training grounds for rebellion. 14,000 died in the camps. Rape, castration, cigarettes, electric shocks and fire were all used by the British to torture the Kenyan people under Churchill's watch. And I will just say that, you know, these were the Mau Mau, and they were particularly brutal themselves. They were cannibalistic. They would torture people. They would do horrific things. So what we've really got here is a case of Churchill's troops doing horrific things, and we've got the Mau Mau doing horrific things. And the way that it's looked at now, Britain's made an official apology for this. It was brought up in the Tommy Robinson interview by RT the other day. This is what they were specifically talking about, saying that the British were raping here. I don't know all the details of it, but I know that people have said that these guys were absolute savages, and the British were just fighting back against savages.
We've probably welcomed them into the country now, haven't we?
they did. They welcomed in the leader. They did, because... Somebody, who was it? It was somebody from the League of Empire Loyalists, and they went and challenged the leader of these Mau Mau. It was somebody I was interviewing a long time back that was around at the time, and they said that what did they do? I think they had they covered him in pig's guts or something, or loads of blood, because he was so bloodthirsty because of all the people he had killed, and that was their protest. Yeah, they were part of the League of Empire Loyalists that became the National Front. So this is promoted now as this horrific treatment of these poor innocent black tribesmen. But the Mau Mau were absolute savages. There was a New York gang that was named after them because they were so brutal and vicious. And I dare say there were a lot of innocent people that were caught up in this. And this was the problem. How are you going to tell the Mau Mau apart from the civilians? It's going to be very difficult to. So, but what they did, they just rounded everybody up and put everybody into these camps. And of course,
I was just going to say, Churchill never thought, second thought about that anyway.
No, well, he did the same.
He
did the same in South Africa, didn't he? So, you can't say this was a racial thing of Churchill's, because he did the same to the white South Africans, put them in camps. Yeah. Maybe he didn't rape and castrate the Boers. That was different here, but this is a response. This is a response to the sort of savagery that we'll see people putting tires around people's necks and then setting fire to them, filling them with petrol and setting fire to them.
Winnie Mandela.
Yeah.
Where execution? Yeah.
Yeah, the same mentality that was doing that was inspiring these Kenyans in their uprising. In 1954, in a British cabinet meeting, Churchill and his men discussed the forced labour of Kenyan prisoners of war and how to circumvent the constraints of the two treaties that they were breaching. This course, detention without trial and forced labour, had been recommended, despite the fact that it was thought to involve a technical breach of the Forced Labour Convention of 1930 and the Convention on Human Rights adopted by the Council of Europe. So, we shouldn't be surprised at Churchill breaking treaties here. I mean, look what they did at the end of the war.
Exactly.
What was it? They designated them unarmed combatants so that they didn't have to abide by the treaties with the German prisoners of war. They called them unarmed combatants.
That's right. Instead of prisoner of war, which gave them the rights of a prisoner, now they had nothing.
And of course, this they just did this again in 1954 in Kenya. The Cowan Plan advocated the use of force and sometimes death against Kenyan prisoners of war who refused to work. Churchill schemed to allow this to continue. Compare that, they're killing people who refuse to work here. Compare that to the German work camps, where they actually gave out tokens where people could buy things in the shop for working.
Proven, yeah.
They weren't told they would be punished if they didn't work, because if you do that, then people are going to be liable to sabotage the machinery, and they're not going to want to work. So they're going to harm things. And if you've got a a working factory or what have you, you want people there that want to work, not people that don't, because there's so much there that could be very easily damaged as well.
Yeah, I can remember one of the prisoners being overjoyed at being able to watch movies. But you can't think for 1 minute that they're going to do this for the Kenyans.
No, the Kenyans were treated far worse than the Germans treated the people in their work camps. Caroline Elkin's book gives a glimpse into the extent of the crimes in Kenya that were known in both official and unofficial circles in Britain, and how Churchill brushed off the terror that the colonial British forces inflicted on the native population. He even punished Edwina Mountbatten for mentioning it. Edwina Mountbatten was conversing about the emergency with India's Prime Minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, and the then Colonial Secretary, Oliver Littleton. When Littleton commented on the terrible savagery of the Mau Mau, Churchill retaliated, refusing to allow Lord Mountbatten to take his wife with him on an official visit to Turkey. So just the fact that this was being mentioned, it was cause to ban Lord Mountbatten's wife from ever going out again on official visits.
There's more to this than meets the eye, though. This tells you where the real power is.
So it's all covered up.
The royal family.
Yeah, well, let's think about this time, 1954 or after that. I mean, was Churchill in power as Prime Minister?
Well, no, I'm not saying he was in power, but I'm saying there's a power behind Churchill, what brought Churchill to power, which got rid of the King of England. And he's now saying that to Lord Mountbatten, you can't take your wife. There's a lot into this, yeah. It tells you really behind the power.
Well, you know, I'm just amazed at this, that so many of the places in the world where the British people are really disliked, and it's actually down to Churchill.
That's the
coincidence that's most interesting about all of this is that
which
so
is
of
why
these things are down to
Hollywood.
Him.
Yeah, spend millions trying to build up his reputation.
Yeah, well, they do, don't they? I mean, that's what you can do. You can look at whoever Hollywood makes out to be a hero, and think, well, they're actually going to be the opposite of that.
Exactly.
And the bad guys, yeah. who Hollywood tells us are the bad guys, when you look in history, they're really the good guys.
Yeah, it is.
Anyway, that brings us to the end of the podcast, Dennis. So thank you very much for coming on today.
Okay.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next Friday with more Truthful Out Radio for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.
RadioAlbion.com